member of my staff could hear President Trump on the phone asking Ambassador Sondland about the investigations. Ambassador Sondland told President Trump the Ukrainians were ready to move forward. Following the call with President Trump, the member of my staff asked Ambassador Sondland what President Trump thought about Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland responded that President Trump cares more about the investigations of Biden, which Giuliani was pressing for.
Bill Taylor, the American ambassador to Ukraine, testifying today before the House Intelligence Committee and dropping what would be one of the only pieces of new news today. He sat alongside another career State Department official, George Kent. It was day one of the public impeachment hearings in which Democrats tried to lay out the case that President Trump wanted Ukrainians to launch investigations that would help his reelection in exchange for military aid. Here's how Chairman Adam Schiff opened the hearing.
Benjamin Franklin was asked what kind of a country America was to become. A republic, he answered, if you can keep it. The fundamental issue raised by the impeachment inquiry into Donald J. Trump is, can we keep it?
And here's how Republican Minority Leader Devin Nunes responded.
This spectacle is doing great damage to our country. It's nothing more than an impeachment process in search of a crime.
And so both sides were set on their paths, the Democrats to prove that Trump had corrupt intent, the Republicans that the Democrats are pursuing a politically motivated investigation with no merit. There is a lot to go over. Let's begin with Philip Bump, national correspondent for The Washington Post. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, well, let's begin with this news that came out of the hearings, this overheard phone call between President Trump and EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland. Why is this significant?
It's significant because one of the things the Democrats have been trying to do is more directly and more frequently tie the requests for new investigations directly to President Trump. And so we've had a lot of evidence that's emerged over the past few weeks of people who were familiar with what President Trump wanted to have happen. This exchange between Sondland and Trump, which is overheard by a staffer for Taylor, would be one of the times beyond the July 25th call itself when Trump is known to have specifically requested these investigations.
And this is new because Taylor didn't know about it until after he gave his deposition.
That's right. He says that he learned only last Friday from this staff member who the Post has reported as someone that works in the embassy in Ukraine. He only heard on Friday from this person had been privy to this conversation.
Right. So meanwhile, what are the Republicans saying about that?
Well, so far, they haven't said a whole lot. I mean, their line of argument has been pretty broadly that there's no there, as you said, that this is a partisan endeavor, and also just trying to argue that President Trump was obviously more worried about corruption than he was about Joe Biden as a political threat.
Right. And so let's hear from another exchange now with Bill Taylor and Adam Schiff. Schiff basically saying that, trying to push Taylor to say that the demand for investigations into the Bidens and into the 2016 campaign were coming directly from President Trump, and it wasn't just Trump's attorney, Rudy Giuliani, freelancing.
Well, and I think the way you express yourself is you wanted Sondland to push back on President Trump's demand, right?
Yes, sir.
So as you're understanding from talking to Sondland, this is what the president wanted him to do, and you wanted Sondland to push back.
I asked Ambassador Sondland to push back. That's correct.
What are you hearing in that exchange?
Yeah, I mean, so one of the aspects here is the extent to which EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland was trying to carry out what President Trump wanted to have happen. There was this meeting in late May in which Sondland, Special Envoy to Ukraine Kurt Volker, and Energy Secretary Rick Perry were sort of tasked with taking the lead on Trump's direct attempts to deal with Ukraine, sort of working outside the State Department, which was something that worried Taylor as soon as he got into his job as acting ambassador. But Sondland, Volker, and Perry were sort of tasked with working with Rudy Giuliani to make things happen in Ukraine. But we learned that Sondland actually ended up working with Trump pretty directly. Sondland was reported to be in contact with Trump regularly. He spoke to Trump immediately before the July 25th call, as he himself has said. And so this is really an example of how Taylor, who was sort of put in this tough position between trying to go through the normal traditional ambassadorial route through the State Department, which he had experience with having served as an ambassador before, and trying to work with this outside group of people trying to influence what was happening in Ukraine, of which Sondland was a part.
So this is the two-track diplomacy that we keep hearing about.
That's exactly what he calls the regular and irregular channel. Sondland was part of that irregular channel.
Right. And so what was Taylor saying about that irregular channel? Was it alarming to him?
Yes. I mean, he came into the job in May. He was asked by Secretary Pompeo to step in after the former ambassador had been fired. Taylor was aware of her ouster. I shouldn't say she was fired. She was sort of asked to step down. It's one of those sort of murky areas. Mm-hmm. He was aware of how she had left the position, how she had been targeted politically, and he was concerned about what Trump's policy on Ukraine was. He steps into the job then and very quickly learns that there is this outside sort of shadow process trying to influence what's going on in Ukraine, in which Giuliani is very actively involved, and that makes it hard for him then to continue on the main track of what he expected to be able to do in his job.
And George Kent, who is sitting next to him in today's hearing, basically echoing the same thing.
That's exactly right. And so these are, you know, these are both longstanding career diplomatic officials, and they were asked at times during their testimony the equivalent of, have you seen things like this before? And both of them sort of indicated that no, they had not, that this was a fairly unique experience. And both of them just definitely suggested that this is not what they were expecting from what their job duties were going to be. This was something pretty exceptional.
Right. Okay. And so given the fact that they are well respected, that they have served other administrations, the ambassador in particular has served Republican administrations, and there really isn't any way to discredit them personally or their motivations. It seemed that the Republican side was basically trying to say, well, you didn't really know what was happening because you weren't there in person. You're getting this sort of third person information. And I just want to play a clip of tape of Ohio Republican Jim Jordan, who is questioning Ambassador Taylor.
Ambassador, you weren't on the call, were you? The president, you didn't listen on President Trump's call and President Lindsey's call?
I did not.
You've never talked with Chief of Staff Mulvaney?
I never did.
You never met the president?
That's correct.
You had three meetings again with Zelensky and it didn't come up.
And two of those they had never heard about, as far as I know.
And President,
there was no reason for it.
President Zelensky never made an announcement. This is what I can't believe. And you're their star witness.
So basically never making an announcement into the investigations that apparently the White House wanted. So is that an effective strategy on the part of the Republicans?
I mean, it remains to be seen. I mean, quite frankly, I'm not sure that there needs to be a particularly effective strategy simply because so much of this already has broken down along party lines. I don't know that the Republicans need to make a particularly detailed argument here. But this certainly is something we've heard from the outset, this idea that, well, if you weren't privy to exactly what happened in the room, then you shouldn't be taken seriously, which was an argument that was made at the beginning when the whistleblower complaint itself first emerged. I think the flaws in that argument are pretty obvious, which is that, yes, maybe it's the case that Taylor wasn't directly in the room, but Taylor's testimony has already forced Sondland to revise his own testimony to say, yes, actually, on September 1st, I did tell an aide to the president of Ukraine that if they didn't have these investigations, they weren't going to get military aid, right? So, yes, it is the case that he may not have been there, but that doesn't mean that what he's saying is necessarily inaccurate, and his testimony has already evoked more accurate firsthand information from other witnesses.
Okay, Philip Bump, national correspondent for The Washington Post. I'll let you go because I know you're very busy. Thank you for joining us.
Of course, my pleasure.
Let's bring in Jessica Levinson now, law professor at Loyola Law School. Welcome back.
Hello.
Well, what did you make of these two as witnesses on day one?
I thought they were enormously effective witnesses who might not move the dial for the reasons that we just talked about, which is people have essentially staked their claim in terms of what they think about the impeachment inquiry. But I thought it was really significant that both witnesses started with their long history of service to the American public. They both talked about how they were not partisan, how they have served presidents from both sides of the aisle. And I think they're essentially trying to insulate themselves from partisan attack. I thought it was a day where it was a great thing that both sides said, let's let a lawyer do some questioning so we didn't have to hear the endless political speeches that Democrats and Republicans tend to engage in. And I think that you just talked about the biggest news, which is this conversation between Sondland and President Trump, and President Trump apparently saying, what's happening with the investigations? This is really important to me. And underscoring the idea that the what he wanted from the Ukrainians was something that was for personal political gain.
All right. Speaking of the lawyers, I want to play a clip of tape from Steve Castor. He's a lawyer for the Republicans questioning George Kent.
Was Hunter Biden a corporate governance expert?
I have no idea what Hunter Biden studied at university or what his CV says.
Mike, is he the Jeffrey Sonnenfeld of the Ukraine?
I have no awareness or knowledge of what his background was and what he may have done on the border.
Okay, so you don't know whether he has any business experience in Ukraine prior to joining Burisma's board?
I've heard nothing about prior experience.
Okay. No. Do you know if he speaks Ukrainian?
I do not.
Do you know if he possesses any other element other than the fact that he is the son of, at the time, the sitting vice president?
I do not.
All right. So what do you think is going on there? It seems like, I'll let you answer that. What do you think is going on there?
Well, I think what's going on here is that there are two doors, and what's behind door number one just doesn't look that good for Republicans. So they're saying, let's go ahead and open door number two, because I don't want you looking in here, which is another way of saying, I think what Republicans are trying to focus on is whether there's potential wrongdoing on behalf of Joe Biden or his son, Hunter Biden. And let's say two things about that. One, there's no evidence that there was legal wrongdoing. I think it makes sense that Hunter Biden received a number of the positions that he did because his last name was Biden. But that has nothing to do with whether or not President Trump engaged in impeachable offenses. And so I think that House Republicans are trying to say, well, bad things happened, and I think Democrats did bad things, and they're trying to kind of muddy and confuse these two separate lines of inquiry. Even if Hunter Biden had engaged in some sort of illegal behavior, that is, again, separate and apart from whether or not President Trump engaged in an impeachable offense.
What about the idea that was brought up many, many times today and has been brought up in the past that, look, Ukraine got its money. No investigations were launched in exchange for that money. No quid pro quo, as we keep hearing. Does that mean that, look, there's nothing to see here? Let's move on.
No, because the law punishes attempted crimes. And so the idea that, well, they eventually got their military aid and, in fact, nobody followed through, there was no investigation, does not in any way undercut the key claims here. Again, the key claims are whether or not President Trump said, I want something of a personal political gain from you, a foreign government, which completely separate from a quid pro quo is a federal election law violation. And then in addition to that, whether or not he engaged in a quid pro quo where he said, if you'd like your military aid, and of course, no one ever says this, but if there was an understanding, if you'd like your military aid, I'd like my help with my reelection campaign. And so that really is, there's a lot of accusations flying back and forth, but that's the crux of what I believe will be drawn up when we talk about the articles of impeachment.
And that is a whole other formal policy that we don't have time to get into now, but hopefully we'll get into later what that actually looks like. How do you draw up articles of impeachment? A whole other thing.
We have a little bit of precedent for that. Luckily, not a ton of precedent, but yes.
Okay, great. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, USC is experiencing a string of student deaths. We'll talk about that next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. And as a warning, we're going to be talking about some sensitive topics in this next segment, including suicide and drug use. We're going to talk about 9 USC students who have died since school began in late August. Campus officials haven't disclosed the cause behind all of the deaths, but 3 have been attributed to suicide. Today, USC President Carol Folt confirmed that the LAPD is looking into drug overdose as a potential cause for some of the other deaths. Joining me to talk about this is Colleen Shelby, reporter at the LA Times. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. So 9, that seems an unusually high number of student deaths. And do we know if any of these deaths are related?
Officials have not said that any of the deaths are related at this point. There has been no commonalities found between any. You're right, 9 is a pretty jarring number, but just for some added context, officials told us that anywhere between 4 to 15 students have died on campus within the past several years. Last year, there were 6 student deaths, but 9 within the span of 3 months is particularly jarring.
Absolutely. And 3 are confirmed as suicides?
That's correct.
And so the other 6, all of those are being investigated as possible drug overdoses?
So USC is working with LAPD investigators who are investigating those deaths as possible drug overdoses or related to tainted drugs.
What kind of tainted drugs?
We are not sure. Officials sent out an email late last night to students warning against opioid use and against mixing drugs with different substances. We know that, you know, across the nation there is an epidemic taking place with opioids and opioid synthetic drug overdoses, and that could be something pertaining to fentanyl mixed with something else. So at this point, we don't know what exactly that could mean. This is, you know, purely in the investigation stage, but that is a possibility at this point.
What is the situation with opioid use in general on college campuses these days?
We know that young people are more likely to die from heroin and fentanyl overdoses than older drug users. We know that there's been an increase in drug use and pertaining to those type of drugs. That would be for anyone between the ages of 15 to 24. So the last numbers from the CDC show that between 2006 and 2016, the rate of drug overdose deaths among people from 15 to 24 increased by about 50%. That's still is less than the rate of drug overdoses for anyone below the age of 15 and over the age of 65. So there's still a lot of information that's being, I think, gathered at this point pertaining to those type of drug overdoses and drug use.
Yeah. Well, how has USC responded to these deaths?
You know, it's a really complicated issue. USC officials are really grappling with putting out enough information to students and families without overburdening people with information. In regards to those 3 suicides, there was real concern that too much information could somehow contribute to a contagion effect, mm-hmm. Which prompted this late night email that went out Saturday night trying to dispel rumors that all of these deaths that had been reported on campus were all suicide related, since that has not been confirmed at this point. But they really are dealing with this in real time. They told me, you know, this is an evolving issue. And as they are receiving more reaction and response from the student body, from parents, from the larger community, that's really taking effect on what information they are distributing to people. So the last batch that went out, information-wise, there was an email that was sent out late last night to students. That email was distributed to faculty today. They told me that in response to some of the other deaths, they've sent emails to the individual schools that the victims were attached to, as opposed to the full student body. It's really been a mix. There hasn't been a clear rule book or policy in terms of how exactly they are giving information or what they're providing. They're also taking into consideration the family wishes. So in at least 3 of the deaths, the school has not released official names for the individuals that died.
Do you know anything about the others?
We have, you know, the names of about 5 of them based off of emails that the university provided to students on campus. We reported on the first death. That was in August, late August 24th, where an incoming freshman was struck by vehicles on the freeway while walking between the fast track lane. That death is still under investigation. But in regards to reporting on the names of the other individuals, we have not done so, but the university has provided some of those names to students.
And again, none of these students knew each other. They weren't related in any way. These are all separate incidents.
As of right now, that's what we've been told, that there have not been any commonalities found between the deaths. But, you know, as they continue to investigate, it's possible things might shift. But at this point, there's been no connection made.
And so how are students in general dealing with this on campus?
Yeah. You know, it seems, again, like it's a really mixed reaction. I spoke with some students who were really angry that there wasn't more information before this student body-wide email went out late Saturday. They felt that there was a lack of transparency, and because of that, you know, people were jumping to conclusions that these deaths were all pertaining to suicide when that wasn't a fact. And, you know, we heard from students who were really disappointed in not knowing about this information earlier. We've also heard from students who feel like, you know, putting out too much information can really have major implications, especially when it comes to students that might be dealing with their own mental health issues. And officials told me that they have heard from students who said that they were unaware of these situations before the Saturday night email went out that have felt emotionally triggered because of this. So at this point, it's really, you know, it's a mixed bag in terms of how students are responding and how parents are responding at this point.
All right. Well, Colleen, thank you. Thank you for your reporting. We'll continue to follow this story.
Thank you for having me.
Colleen Shelby, reporter at the LA Times. And if you or someone you know is having suicidal thoughts, please contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. It's up and running 24/7 at 1-800-273-8255. Or you can send a text to the crisis text line by texting the word HOME to 741741. Coming up, the U.S. tested nuclear bombs in the Marshall Islands more than 60 years ago. The fallout still threatens the country today.
This stuff actually holds like metallic pieces of plutonium that if they were to be released into the lagoon or to the wider ocean and washed up on the shore, it could make people very sick.
The problem of climate change and nuclear waste next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Back in the 1940s and 50s, the United States conducted dozens of nuclear tests on the Marshall Islands. And those tests forced people from their homes. They left residents exposed to radioactive material when they returned to the islands years later. Even after the United States stopped testing nukes there, it still shipped radioactive waste from nuclear tests in Nevada and dumped more than 100 tons of that waste into a concrete dome on one of the Marshall Islands. Well, now that dome is at risk of collapsing because of climate change and rising sea levels. Suzanne Rust reported on this for the LA Times in a year-plus long investigation. She joins me now. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, let's begin with some background on the Marshall Islands and how they became a nuclear test site for the United States following World War II. Marshall Islands, way out in the Pacific, far, far away from the United States. Why was the United States conducting nuclear tests there?
Well, just after the war, the United States had, you know, clearly tried nuclear weapons on Japan and wanted to sort of see what kind of arsenal they had, figure out how big they could make bombs, test them on water, test them in the air, test them on land. And the Marshall Islands, which at this point had been through the war, sort of first occupied by Japan, then occupied by the Allies, and then it became a UN trust territory, was put under the auspices of the United States. And military experts decided it would be a great place far away from the United States mainland to try these weapons out. They talked about it as a remote place where nobody lived. Clearly, there were lots of people who lived here who would disagree that they mm-hmm. didn't live there. Nevertheless, it was far away from the United States and from any of the major continents, so it was chosen as a place to try these things out.
And when did the U.S. stop testing weapons there?
The U.S. stopped testing weapons in 1958, or at least nuclear weapons in 1958. They were concerned that a moratorium was coming along with the Soviet Union and the U.K. at the end of 1958. So from the records we have, I think between April and August, they detonated over 30 bombs just to try to get everything in before the moratorium came into effect.
And so are the residents there still coping with the fallout, so to speak, from that?
Yes, the residents are still dealing with it. So the United States used two of the atolls. There are 29 atolls in the Marshall Islands, and they used two of them to test these atomic weapons. There was Bikini, which most people have heard of from SpongeBob and the bathing suit, and Eniwetok. And these were the most remote of the atolls. They were the most north and sort of west. And so both of those atolls were highly irradiated from 67 nuclear bombs that were detonated in these atolls. There was another one that was also affected, Rongelap, and that was east of these atolls. And what happened there was there was one bomb that was detonated in Bikini. It was the largest bomb that the U.S. detonated. It was 1,000 times larger than Hiroshima. That bomb's fallout carried over to Rongelap, as well as several other atolls, but mostly on Rongelap, and dropped the fallout there, contaminating the islands, the people. Last summer, Columbia University published a study. They went and walked around some of the islands in Rongelap and discovered one of them is more radioactive than Fukushima and Chernobyl.
Oh, my gosh. And so are people sickened from that?
People definitely were sickened from it, you know, immediately after the fallout occurred in 1954. And when people were resettled later in that decade, their radiation levels went up, and again, they were sickened. There's question that, well, first of all, very few people live in Rongelap now. Nobody lives in Bikini except for a few contractors, and I think maybe 600 people live in Eniwetok. Right now, it's a lot of nobody really knows if people are still getting sick by living there. The only people who do these studies is the U.S. government. They have told the Marshallese, as well as the rest of the world, that everything is safe. But not surprisingly, the Marshallese are a bit suspect.
Okay, let's look at this dome that's holding all the nuclear waste. It's called the Runet Dome.
That's correct. The Marshallese call it the tomb.
Just the tomb. And it's made out of what? Concrete?
It's made out of concrete. So, again, Eniwetok was one of, like, the centers for the atomic testing of the United States. And when the United States had finished up their atomic testing there, they actually spent the next two decades doing other kinds of tests, including biological weapons testing. They sent ICBMs from California to blow up on Eniwetok. They had left this atoll so polluted, so contaminated, that before turning it back to the Marshallese, they promised to clean it up. And so what they did was they scraped up soil, they picked up debris, and they dropped it all into the bottom of an unlined crater on Runet Island. The crater was created by a nuclear bomb. So they dumped it in there, mixed a lot of it with cement, and then covered it with an 18-inch thick concrete cap, and that is still there today.
But in an unlined crater.
In an unlined crater that even in the 1970s when they were building this, experts and engineers were saying it was leaking even back then. Today, the DOE has looked at it. They admit that the dome is still leaking. The situation is becoming worse because of climate change. So as sea levels rise, water is getting higher and higher into the dome and clearly flushing out more and more contaminants. Groundwater is becoming increasingly contaminated. And there are concerns that the dome could actually collapse under increasing wave height and storm frequency and intensity.
So, yeah, wow. What would happen if the dome collapsed and all that waste came out of it and washed into the ocean?
So, again, it's unclear. I mean, just to note how remote these islands are, it takes, from the U.S. mainland, it takes 2 days to get there. You have to fly to Honolulu, spend the night there, take a morning flight out, and then go out to the island, and then take, so not even 2 days, it takes 2 days to get to the Marshall Islands, and then another 2 days if you're going by boat to get from Majuro, which is where the airport is, off to these islands. Very remote. So the U.S. government is really the only one who's gone out there to do research and reported on this. And what they say right now is if the dome were to collapse, it would be no big deal because the atoll and the lagoon are already so polluted that the contents of the dome collapsing would be insignificant. It would add nothing new or more dangerous to the already highly contaminated lagoon. However, other experts say that's nonsense. The tomb holds the most lethal and contaminated debris. And the stuff actually holds like metallic pieces of plutonium that were, if they were to be released into the lagoon or to the wider ocean and washed up on the shore, it could make people very sick.
Well, how imminent is this threat of collapse?
Nobody really knows. It could be tomorrow, it could be 10 years, it could be 100. It's unclear.
So is anyone doing anything about this as to try to shore up this dome or to try to prevent this from happening?
No. The Marshallese are really concerned about it. The Marshall Islands does not have a lot of money to spend. And so they're hoping somebody, whether it be the United Nations or the United States, will come in and help. The United States has renounced all responsibility for the dome. They said that in 1986, when they handed the Marshallese government back to the Marshallese, they paid them $150 million at the time and released themselves of all future obligations to the country concerning the nuclear waste. So they say it's not their responsibility. And what it would take to shore up the dome clearly would require a lot of money, and Marshallese don't have it.
You quote an expert in your story as saying that the Marshall Islands face humanity's two greatest threats, nukes, nuclear weapons, and the fallout from that, and climate change. And here they are essentially helpless to do anything about it, two problems that they did not create, the people on the islands.
Yeah, it's really tragic to see. They completely epitomize this issue, as a result of our own quest for security and prosperity. The Marshallese have suffered the consequences of that, right? Releasing all these atomic bombs and showing the world the might and the strength of the United States. And then the burning of fossil fuels that we created to, you know, make the country that we live in today. It is basically the Marshall Islands that have scrubbed up through the unintended and negative consequences of all of that. And it's a tragedy to see. The Marshallese, however, as they have been since, you know, they were first occupied by the Germans and then the Japanese, are fighters, and they are not going to go down as victims. And their president keeps saying, you know, we're going to do something about this. We're not just going to lie back and let this happen.
Suzanne Rust, she's a reporter at the LA Times. You can read her story on the Marshall Islands there. Suzanne, thank you, and thank you for your investigation.
Thank you for having me.
Climate change affecting how people live, also where they live, and now whether or not they can get a mortgage. The 30-year mortgage might become a casualty of global warming. And that's because rising sea levels, worsening drought, and wildfires make the future of many homes uncertain. Here to tell us what this means for the U.S. economy is Jesse Keenan. He teaches at Harvard's Graduate School of Design, and he teaches a course on climate change resilience and adaptation. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. All right, so what is the problem here? Banks are just no longer going to issue 30-year mortgages in places that could be affected by rising sea levels and other effects of climate change?
So what we see now is emerging evidence by between buyers and sellers of housing that suggests that there's discounting behavior. That is, they're accepting more and they're paying less for housing. We think that behavior is starting to translate in the mortgage market. And so in very high-risk areas associated with sea level rise, flooding, forest fires, and the like, we anticipate that mortgagees, banks, are going to start pulling back on the availability of capital in mortgage markets.
But they haven't done it yet.
It's hard to know. We think that there's certainly behavior where they are passing on risk to the secondary markets like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, essentially the U.S. government. But we haven't seen what you would call a risk premium necessarily in the mortgage markets. But we think we will be there in a number of years.
Well, what you're describing, though, describes a large portion of the United States, places that are prone to sea level rise, to flooding, to fires. It certainly describes a large portion of coastal California.
Coastal California is a little bit different because of the variations in elevation. But just to give you an example, with sea level rise inundation zones in the United States, that's about going up to about 6 feet towards the end of the century, which is in line with various government models and estimates, that would account between about 8 and 10% of annual mortgage issuance in the United States. So that's a big number in terms of the total amount of money being invested in these communities.
Does it mean they're not going to offer the 30-year mortgage, but they might offer the 15-year or something less, or are they not going to offer mortgages at all?
I think it's really going to vary by the market, by the adaptation or resilience interventions that are helping manage some of the risk in particularly high-income or high-value communities. But I think it's going to run a spectrum of increased interest rates, shorter-term mortgages, and in some communities, in some submarkets, I think we're going to see very limited availability of mortgages.
But you're saying that in places where the housing stock is more expensive or they're richer homeowners, they might be immune to this because they can always pay?
Well, it's not that they're immune. It's that local communities, let's say at a county level or public municipalities, may be willing to put in the investments to help manage and mitigate some of this risk so they can protect their tax base. And that also not only protects homeowners, but it protects the banks as well.
Well, so I guess what you're painting is a possible picture of homeowners who are stuck in places that are terribly affected by climate change, maybe with flooding, who won't be able to sell their homes if they want to get out.
Yeah, I think they're stuck in different ways. You know, part of it may be a rapid devaluation or some devaluation in their home, but it may also impact in slightly more subtle ways. If you think about the amount of the older people in America who use reverse mortgages to tap into equity or to use a second mortgage as a means to help pay for their child to go to school. You know, when we talk about devaluation in housing, it has a broader impact on our ability to utilize that equity, and that will further the necessity to think about managed retreat.
Wow. So is there anything being done to mitigate this, to prevent this from happening?
Well, I think we're very early stages of understanding the geophysical risk. As that technology is moving forward, and it's moving very quickly, markets will utilize that information to begin parceling through the risk and the uncertainty. Within the next 5 years, we're going to have greater resolution about how markets are going to be responding to this. Because remember, very often these mortgages are issued for 30 years out. And I think 30 years seems like a long time, but certainly that's well within a very high probability of outcome associated with a lot of climate models. And so we have a pretty good sense of those houses that will very likely be underwater at the end of their mortgage term.
How many houses are you talking about that'll be underwater, do you think? And by underwater, we're not talking like physically underwater. We're talking about underwater in a mortgage sense.
Yes, yes. So there's been great work done by the Union of Concerned Scientists that have looked at the total amount of properties that are potentially at risk that are borrowing money today for a 30-year mortgage term. And it's in the order of, you know, hundreds of thousands of properties. This will impact, it's pretty crazy that we are so slow in thinking and internalizing these processes. But with technology and better measurement science, we're getting there.
So hundreds of thousands of homes you're anticipating by the end of their 30-year mortgage, if they're written today, could be underwater financially.
Well, yes, financially and physically.
But do you anticipate a similar figure or a similar problem that homes that are in areas that have a high probability of burning are going to see their value decrease substantially, and that perhaps by the end of 30 years, they'll be underwater?
Yeah, this is what we see and would anticipate. This isn't just with advances in fire science of understanding the underlying risk associated with particular properties. This also applies the availability of potable water when wells run dry, which requires homes to be, you can't lawfully live in a home if you don't have water, for instance. It relates to subsidence or unstable soils from landslides in the Mountain West. There's any number of physical impacts from climate change that represent real collateral risks to people's homes. And over time, as we have, again, better science, we'll get a better understanding of what that means in terms of risk.
So I guess it's the market doing what the government and what we are not doing, which is to say you can't live in this place. It's too risky.
Yeah, and I think that this represents a real challenge because there is no doubt that people will be trapped in their homes. They will be unable to necessarily sell. It's a game of musical chairs, and the question is, who are the last people standing? And I think this reinforces a movement we see now across the United States as represented by recent legislation in Texas about consumer disclosure and the necessity to have transparency when you're buying and selling homes to put people on notice that, hey, this place flooded or this place caught on fire one time. So disclosure is, I think, critical to help mitigate some of the unintended consequences of this market behavior.
Jesse Keenan teaches at Harvard's Graduate School of Design, and he teaches a climate change and resilience and adaptation course there. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, eating meat is a significant cause of CO2 emissions. Well, now some companies are addressing that by creating a meatless meat made out of thin air. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. You've heard of Impossible Meat. You've heard of Beyond Burger, meat made from vegetables and other non-meaty ingredients. Well, now there's something called air protein, meat made from, air. Several companies are doing it, converting elements from the air into edible protein. Janelle Bitker wrote about this for the San Francisco Chronicle, and she joins me now. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, first things first, what does it taste like?
I have no idea what it tastes like. The companies are in the very, very early days, and I didn't get to taste a sample. As far as I know, no reporters have tasted a sample. But they say the protein that comes out, it looks like flour and doesn't taste like anything. And then they add natural flavors to it to make it taste like chicken or beef.
Well, okay, so obvious follow-up question. If it doesn't taste like anything, what's in it?
It's made out of microorganisms and air. The elements in air are basically fed to these specific microbes, which can then convert elements like carbon dioxide into this protein flour.
So the elements of air are what? Carbon dioxide, oxygen.
Yeah, and then with some companies, they also use hydrogen.
And then there's other stuff in the air too, right? Stuff we don't like pollen, dirty stuff, smog.
Sure. These companies have to capture the elements that they want. I think the long-term vision for these companies is that they would be stationed near or paired with energy plants, any sort of company that combusts and therefore releases intense carbon dioxide, basically.
So what is the general idea? It seems like a lot of effort to go into.
Sure. Well, I think these companies are thinking about the climate apocalypse and are trying to find ways to make food without using so much land and water and other resources. Beef, for example, uses a ton of resources, tons of land, and releases a lot of methane and greenhouse gases just from belching, for example. And so that's, as you said earlier, the Impossible Burger, Beyond Meat, that's where they come in. They're trying to create these alternative proteins that taste like the real thing. So this is just another sector of that industry where they're trying to create something that uses even less land and even less water than, say, Impossible Burger.
Would it require any water?
They say it requires 1,000 times less water than soybeans, which is what Impossible is using. They're using, well, they're not even using soybeans. They're using soy protein isolate. But any water, some water is needed just for you know, cleaning and sanitation, I'd imagine.
And then it, as you say, becomes like a flour and then
reformulated
into meat-like patties.
Right. So this Berkeley company that claims to be the first in the world to make meat out of air is called Air Protein. And they were very secretive about how they actually make the flour into something that tastes like meat. But, yeah, somehow they do it. They add natural flavors. And the thing they were mostly secretive about was how they get the texture of meat out of the flour.
Well, I guess they could just make flour and use that. I mean, that's also a way to help the environment. It's to grow less wheat.
Absolutely. And I think that's part of their long-term goal. They're starting with this sort of flashy air-based meat. But down the line, they plan to release protein-enriched flour, protein-enriched pasta, cereal, protein bars, protein shakes. You can make a lot of things just with the flour. And that's what this other Finnish company called Solar Foods announced earlier this summer, that they've arrived and they're making protein out of air. That's what they're starting with, is just the flour.
Is this technology relatively new, and who came up with it?
Yeah, so it's based on actually pretty old research from NASA. NASA theorized that when they send astronauts to Mars, that they could breathe out carbon dioxide and they could get microbes to then produce food out of that carbon dioxide. So there was a lot of research about it from the 60s. And these companies seemingly all at once globbed onto this research and actually tried testing it on Earth, because in ways, Earth is kind of like a spacecraft. There are limited resources and people want to recycle carbon dioxide.
All right. When do you think we'll be able to taste this air meat?
I don't have a good answer for that. The Berkeley company Air Protein only would say that they will release more details and make announcements next year about their distribution plans, whether that's in the U.S. or overseas. I imagine will depend on regulatory agencies, since they'll have to go through a long process to prove that their product is safe for human consumption. But I've read that the Finnish company plans to release their product starting in 2021. That might be the earliest.
Well, I will wait for it with bated breath. Couldn't resist. Janelle Bitker, food enterprise reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you later.